TexasObserver.org, you're listening to Observer Radio. I'm your host, Jonathan McNamara. This is a half-hour radio news show in which we ask the Texas Observer staff to take a break from writing things and say things to you on the radio instead. This week, we've got Observer Associate Editor Forrest Wilder in the studio. Welcome, Forrest.
Hey, Jonathan. How's it going?
It's going well, man.
Awesome.
Also with us is freelance writer Carolyn Jones. Hey, Carolyn.
Thanks for having me.
Always a pleasure to have you on the show. Later in the show, we'll be joined by State Fire Marshal Chris Keneally and Observer contributor Priscilla Mosqueda to talk about her story, Hero Complex, which asks if dampening a culture of heroism can keep firefighters safer. But first, we have some news to discuss, and I think we should really start with you, Carolyn. Tell us about what's going on with HB2.
Well, a new lawsuit has been filed against a portion of HB2 that has been described by some as a very draconian, the most draconian aspect of the bill, in that the...
And what is the bill? HB2?
The bill itself, House Bill 2, is what passed during our legislative session last year. It increases the restrictions on abortion providers in Texas. There are four parts to it, just to go through those quickly. The four parts of the bill first of all, a ban on abortion after 20 weeks gestation, a restriction on the use of medication abortions, the requirement that all abortion providers in Texas have admitting privileges at nearby hospitals, and the fourth bit, the bit that I described that some describe as draconian, is the ambulatory surgical care center requirement, which means that all abortion clinics in Texas have to upgrade their facilities to be like mini hospitals.
Which is what?
Mini, small, like little miniature hospitals.
That's right. So the requirements would be that you would have to take your standard abortion clinic and widen the hallways. You would have to have a very specific ceiling height. It even defines how large the janitorial closets should be, how many parking spots you should have outside. It defines what the air conditioning unit needs to be like. And this is fine if you were doing surgery in, you know, what would be described as a mini hospital. But opponents of this measure say that this is not necessary for provision of abortions, which are, many of them are medication abortions, which is simply taking a pill.
Right.
So, and I guess the question is, first of all, why is the legislature involved in prescribing such specific things for a medical facility? And then second of all, which is, well, what's the big deal about widening a hallway or putting in a different type of AC unit?
Right. Firstly, the legislators are involved in it ostensibly because they say it improves the health and safety of the women who are going to these clinics for their abortions. Opponents of the measure say, actually, the width of the hallway has nothing to do with the safety of women who are going in there to take a pill or to have a very minimally invasive procedure, which is what an abortion procedure is. So we're talking about health and safety here, but we're also talking about requiring these clinics to make very expensive upgrades. So, for example, a 5,000 square foot clinic would cost about $3 million to upgrade it to meet these requirements. And many abortion clinics, many of which are standalone clinics across Texas, can simply not afford to make that kind of upgrade.
Right.
So whilst we're talking about health and safety from the legislator's point of view, what the providers are saying is actually this is a way to make us, to force us out of business.
So and bring us up to date, there's been a number of legal challenges to the four provisions of House Bill 2 so far. And this is this lawsuit that was filed this week is specifically around the ambulatory surgical center standards. What's happened with the other suits, and why is this one coming so much later?
Right. Well, actually, one part of House Bill 2 has not been challenged in the courts, and that's the 20-week ban. The other three parts have. The lawsuit that was filed on Wednesday was actually had two parts to it. The first one was challenging the requirement that all of these clinics upgrade to become ambulatory surgical care centers. That part of the bill is only set to go into effect on September 1st of this year. So I think that's why the plaintiffs waited that long to file the suit. The second part of the lawsuit that was filed was also trying to overturn another portion of HB2, which was the admitting privileges requirement. That part of the bill has been challenged since last fall, and it's been ricocheting between the courts. It was first of all heard in the District Federal Court in Austin, where the judge found in favor of the plaintiffs, which means he agreed with the abortion providers and advocates who say admitting privilege requirement and the restrictions on medication abortion is unduly burdensome. That judge agreed.
And is that because of the distance people would have to travel to find clinics that are still open?
That's right, because the admitting privileges requirement is so onerous for many clinics to achieve that a number of providers in Texas have had to stop offering abortions as a result. So it's reduced access, and therefore it becomes more burdensome for women trying to access their abortion services. So the district judge found in favor of the providers. The state appealed immediately. It went up to the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals based in New Orleans. And just a few weeks ago, the Fifth Circuit found in favor of the state, saying, actually, this is constitutional. This will go ahead. So the lawsuit that was filed this week was continuing to challenge the admitting privileges requirement, but focusing specifically on two geographic areas. So focusing on McAllen in the Rio Grande Valley and El Paso, saying, okay, well, the admitting privileges requirement is going ahead, as the Fifth Circuit has determined, but there are two geographic regions in Texas that, if this goes ahead, there will be no abortion providers for vast distances, and they're asking the district court to reconsider and put a block on that requirement for these two geographic areas.
If the plaintiffs in this most recent lawsuit lose on the ambulatory surgical care center requirement specifically, what is the estimate of how many remaining abortion clinics there would be in the state of Texas? Is there a count?
Yeah, the estimate would be that there would be fewer than 10 clinics left in the state. And just to give you a sense of the numbers here, before HB2 went into effect, there were 44 abortion clinics across Texas, and access was already a problem. HB2 went into effect, and that number dropped to 34. Then when the district court, the admitting privileges requirement kicked in, that number dropped to somewhere around between 20 and 24 clinics. So we're talking about a precipitous drop now down to fewer than 10. And these will be focused in major urban areas, Austin, Dallas, Houston, San Antonio. So as the plaintiffs outlined in their lawsuit this week, women who are in El Paso, for example, would then have to travel, make a round trip of upwards of 1,000 miles to access an abortion in Texas, because they would be traveling from El Paso all the way to San Antonio and back, or they could go out of state. But we're talking about sort of in-state travel here.
And even right now, for example, the Rio Grande Valley, you would have to go to San Antonio, right? That's the nearest clinic.
Well, right now you can go to Corpus Christi.
Oh, excuse me, Corpus Christi. But it could still be a four-hour round trip or something like that for some people.
That's right. And that's incredibly burdensome for people who don't have easy access to their own transport, who may not be able to get time off work, who have other children and aren't able to get, you know, the child care set up, not to mention the cost of gas and accommodation. So this has a big impact on people who are already, I mean, the Rio Grande Valley, one third of the population are in poverty. So this has a real impact on them.
I guess the last question I would ask is how do you see this moving forward?
I see the courts being involved in this for a long time to come. But possibly based on precedent, it could then, federal district court could find in favor of the plaintiffs again, but the state will immediately appeal it up to the Fifth Circuit, which we have seen a precedent going back all the way to the Sonogram Bill in 2011 and even earlier. They are not in favor of abortion providers in general, so likely that the Fifth Circuit will find in favor of the state again. So the question after that is, what will the abortion providers decide to do? Will they decide to appeal up to the U.S. Supreme Court? Good question.
Well, and a lot hangs in the balance there.
Absolutely, it would be a gamble to take it all the way up to the U.S. Supreme Court because with its current composition.
Then you're dealing with a precedent that could affect all 50 states rather than just what the Fifth Circuit covers.
Exactly, that would be a very risky move, and I think everyone is watching that. I mean, these decisions are being made in different state houses across the U.S. as these restrictions are being challenged in various courts.
Well, Carolyn, thank you so much for being on the show.
Thank you for having me.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to Observer Radio, a half-hour news show from the folks at the Texas Observer. The April edition of the Observer features a piece by Priscilla Mosqueda called Hero Complex, which asks if dampening a culture of heroism can keep firefighters safer in Texas. Priscilla, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Can you give us a sense of your story?
Sure. So the story is about firefighter deaths that happen in the line of duty, and more specifically, deaths that happen in situations where firefighters maybe didn't need to go into or near a fire. And often there are deaths and injuries that happen that way. 2013 was the deadliest year for firefighters in Texas. 17 firefighters died, 10 of them in West, and then 7 others in 3 fires in Bryan, Dallas, and Houston. So it was a bad year, and that's what prompted the story. So the story looks at the reasons behind why this continues to happen, not just in Texas, but at the national level. And there are some cultural things within the fire service that contribute to this a lot. There's this idea of being a hero, which of course all firefighters are, but there's an idea of needing to prove it by sometimes taking risks that are not necessary and that often are deadly.
So based on your reporting, what would be an unnecessary risk?
The fire marshal can talk about this more than I can, but for example, there's a house that's on fire and it's heavily involved. There's a lot of flames, a lot of smoke, and maybe there's not a person inside. And so there's, at that point, not really a need to go inside. There's a saying in the fire service that you risk a lot to save a lot, you risk a little to save a little, and you risk nothing to save nothing. So in that instance, if you're not saving a life, maybe there's not a lot of property to save. There's no point in risking a firefighter's life for that.
Right. One of the things I found interesting about your story is you talk about an aggressive attack and a defensive attack against a fire. Can you talk about what the difference of those two are?
Yeah, so an offensive attack is when you go inside and fight the fire from the inside, and defensive is when you stay outside and like spray water on it. And so sometimes there's a switch, and sometimes it's better to just stay outside and do a defensive attack, but firefighters go inside and do an offensive attack when it's not necessary. And that's a lot of the times how they die. There's a structural collapse or something that happens.
So there's this sort of, I mean, I guess the word that comes to mind is macho heroism kind of culture. What can be done about that? How do you change a culture?
Something someone in the fire service could answer better than I can. But from what I was told by people who have been in the fire service for years, such as State Fire Marshal Chris Keneally, it has to start with the leadership, with the fire chiefs, and also in training academies, with emphasizing safety in training and then enforcing it once those candidates enter departments and become firefighters.
I see. Well, maybe to that end, we should go ahead and introduce our guest. We have with us via phone State Fire Marshal Chris Keneally. Thank you so much for being on the show.
Yes, thank you for having me this afternoon.
Absolutely. So in your experience, how do you sort of combat this culture of heroism and machoism that seems to be part of the firefighter, experience?
Well, the culture evolves over the years inside a fire department, and certainly fire departments are imposed by other fire departments. Where the organization takes great pride in being very aggressive in their firefighting tactics. I grew up in the Houston Fire Department, spent 26 years there, and the culture was what I refer to as the fire gods. Those were legendary in their firefighting prowess and how much heat they could take going inside the structure. And you know, the thought that peer pressure stops at high school is very much misguided, and it continues, and certainly in the fire departments on steroids, where we want to emulate these people that are highly respected in their firefighting skill sets. And certainly in Houston, it's how far we could go and how deep into the fire, to the point where it was honorable to melt your fire helmet, get burns to your protective clothing, to reinforce your image of a very tough, aggressive firefighter. And consequently, as you're going deeper and taking more risk on, that you find yourself ultimately, and you don't realize it because the culture is really and courage is to take a necessary risk to go in. We're going in environments where there's no way that a human being could survive that without firefighter clothing and self-contained breathing apparatus and all that stuff, that we're going to situations where the only thing there's maybe possibly is to save property, and the risk the firefighters are incurring on this property is way outside that balance. So the risk versus gain, the gain being saving lives primarily, very much secondarily is saving property. And if the structure with lightweight truss construction, we have so much more heat produced with so many plastics and combustible materials and structures, more so than years past, that it's a perfect environment for bad things to occur. And that's what Priscilla wrote about, and I'll say quite effectively, of identifying that culture that impacts that risk versus gain, where we have a number of firefighters being killed for no appreciable gain of why they entered the structure. And it's largely because of that culture developing that encourages risk, firefighters wanting to be heroes, and certainly, you know, you encourage that to a degree. You don't want to hire timid firefighters that are not willing to incur some risk. They'll be aggressive in their tactics, but you have to be very smart as well. And there's an imbalance there what we're finding in the number of line-of-duty deaths each year that occur in the state that, quite frankly, should have never happened because the risk was not appropriate for what the firefighters entered for. Well, some alleged gain, and someone may be trapped in there, and there's no way they could, a human being could survive that without having all the protective clothing the firefighter has.
In reading this story, for me, though, it sounds like you are part of a campaign that's trying to change this culture. And it seems like you're getting a lot of pushback, and that's very difficult for me to understand. Why is there pushback about being safer?
Well, there's pushback because that's what the firefighters, in many cases, because of that, again, culture, that's what they value. And when you're teaching against those values, that's not always appreciated. And certainly, you know, the intent is to make sure firefighters go home at the end of their shift. And there's a program that we have at the National Fallen Firefighter Foundation created. It was called Courage to Be Safe. And quite frankly, it takes courage to go against that culture and call it out and say, this is not right. And what we're doing in Texas now, while the State Fire Marshal has, you know, statutory authority to investigate a lot of duty deaths, I believe, in doing things in a very collaborative way. All the different fire stakeholder associations in the state I've consulted with, and they all agreed that what is happening and the tone of these past line of duty death reports being kind of what I refer to as kindler and gentler approach is not getting the fire service attention. And what's happening in Texas is endemic elsewhere in the nation, that constantly pushing to be more aggressive, and there's not very many voices saying to do otherwise except in various areas within the National Fire Service. And so we've all agreed, being these various representatives that represent firefighters in different capacities all over the state, that we've had enough, and the tone of our line of duty death reports will be much more direct. People will be held accountable for decisions that they make. And, you know, our sole mission is to make sure firefighters survive that incident. You know, I'm sick and tired of firefighters dying needlessly. And a lot of what Priscilla wrote about was this hero complex that, you know, who doesn't want to be a hero? And who doesn't want to be respected by your peers? In many cases, these peers value taking unnecessary risks that, you know, there's always going to be some risk part of this profession. And certainly, you got a high-rise fire and you got people trapped, you know, you have to go in. And that's the way it is. But any of these structures where firefighters are going in, that the fire is consuming the structure to such a degree that it's not expected to stay upright. So you don't have collapse. You have these flashovers. conditions, because all of these BTUs that are being created in this fire environment, that it's ripe for disaster. And
right.
We've, as Priscilla stated, 80% of these fires she looked at in this time period since 2001 took on unnecessary risk. And we have to have a very frank discussion amongst ourselves to make sure that we balance that risk versus gain appropriately.
Do you think that the public will or does second-guess decisions where firefighters choose to stand down and not go into, say, a burning building or a situation where they opt to fight the fire, from the outside or basically not go in? Do you think there's a risk of the public second-guessing that decision?
Well, I think the public in many cases just really have no idea what is going on, because quite frankly, this is very much internal to the profession. While they see outcomes of firefighters dying, for sure, there's the, I always say, City Hall is not telling firefighters they have to incur significant risk. And while there's all these issues with staffing or equipment needed for fire departments, but, we're the ones making internal decisions based on our training of how we manage that risk versus gain environment. And the public should expect their fire department to be following national best practices. And when you're not complicit with those best practices, the public should be concerned. But quite frankly, it's a leadership issue from the fire chief and to the command structure. That command structure sets the tone for the organization, what's acceptable. And if it's winking at it, we get it, we're going to do that. But in action, you're not following it. There should be accountability, whether it be from governmental leaders and or the public. And that's not popular, and I will be the first one to admit that.
Right.
But, the cause is right in the sense that we can't keep on doing the same thing and expect different results.
Right.
That's the definition of crazy. And while firefighters are, and there's many very progressive fire departments in Texas, but we also have many that are not following these national best practices, and they need to be guided and hopefully coached and trained to change what they're doing. And if they're not, there needs to be accountability, even to the degree of leadership changes.
Right. Priscilla has a question for you.
Do you think that those progressive chiefs who are really emphasizing safety and really enforcing those things that firefighters learn in the academy, do you think that that is a minority in Texas, or do you think that it's growing? I mean, those are two questions, I guess. Do you think it's a minority, and do you think that that's going to change, that it's going to become...
Well, it's hard to say exactly. I would tell you there is many organizations that are working hard to do it right. I'm hopeful that it's the minority that's still causing these issues, but I have to say that I have concerns that while in many cases I think there's more lip service to that level of progressiveness than actual deeds being done to make sure that we are complicit with those best practices. And so I do have concerns that many organizations are not embracing it. And you'll go to conferences and you'll have those that are hanging on to every word, and they are studying all the latest trends and the fire service and all the things that's impacting us. And then you have others that are just, this is how they want to fight fire. And while, I guess that's their choice, but that's not the right choice. And I don't think anyone has the right to put firefighters under their command in a bad environment that was totally avoidable.
Before we run out of time, I've got a question I really want to ask you, which is, I know you're on a tour educating firefighters about ammonium nitrate, which was obviously caused the explosion in West Texas about a year ago. What kind of reaction have you been getting from those sessions and from the firefighters you're speaking with?
Well, there's 66 counties that have this ammonium nitrate, 10,000 pounds or more. And we've done 14 meetings thus far. And overwhelmingly, and I'm very encouraged by this, the firefighters are embracing what's being discussed, and even to the point, you know, because we do evaluations after each presentation, and they are passing those comments, not only not like they like the class, but saying, you know, we need this. And time and time again, getting affirmation of that. So I am believing this is very productive, and the loss of officially 10 firefighters, but there's 12 responders and less. I've never seen anything like that in my career here in the past 36 years that I've witnessed. And it's had a profound impact on me and many leaders in the Texas Fire Service that this has got to stop. And while we don't discuss the details of what occurred in West until that report's released next month, and we give opportunity for the families and the fire chiefs to see it first. But after that, these presentations, we're going to go in great detail what happened in West. Inevitably, there's always lessons learned. But I will tell you, this is not just a small volunteer fire department versus the big paid. Both entities, from the smallest to the largest departments, have this challenge of evaluating risk versus gain appropriate, as you read in these line of duty death reports, from the largest departments in the state to the smallest. It shows up consistently, and that needs to be eradicated. So this is not a volunteer firefighter versus paid firefighter issue, and who's more professional. Quite frankly, there's room for improvement in all aspects, and I'll say this about Chris Cahill as well. None of us have arrived, but we got to be aggressive in pursuing these changes, and that's what part of this ammonium nitrate tour is about. Great loss from Wes, but we also discuss other general firefighter safety issues that I found thus far resonating very well with firefighters. I think this past year in 2013, losing 18 firefighters, 17 on the fire ground, which is extremely unusual. It's the third leading cause of death of asphyxia, running out of air, burns, or structural collapse. Usually it's heart attacks, strokes, and vehicle accidents that are the leading causes. Well, that's just the opposite. And I think the timing is right, and very thankful for Priscilla's article that is resonating. I will tell you right now throughout the National Fire Service, the feedback I'm getting, that this is long overdue, and they like what they hear, what Texas is trying to do.
Well, Mr. Keneally, thank you so much for being on our show today.
Yes, well, thank you for the opportunity, and also, Priscilla, thank you for doing such a great job.
Thank you.
We've unfortunately reached the end of this episode, but before we go, I'd like to thank Rosie and the Ramblers for providing our music, and of course, a big thanks to all of you out there listening to us. Observer Radio is recorded at the lovely Co-op Radio Studios in Austin, Texas. Our sound engineer is Tracy Scholes. For more Texas news and culture, visit us on the web at texasobserver.org, or you can pick up the latest copy of the Texas Observer at a store near you. We'll talk to you again next time on Observer Radio.